Some more questions.
I was rather interested to hear you saying that you spoke for approximately 50, 55 minutes.
Yes, only at the evangelistic banquets. Because I start off with humor, I tell a narrative all through, they're laughing, well, you'll see tonight if you're here tonight. There's a lot of humor. And then there's a wrap-up prayer and a wrap-up explanation. The actual body of the talk may only be 40 minutes. But it's interspersed all the way through with humor. I'd never try a sermon that long. It is not a sermon. I used Bob Hope illustration a moment ago. He came to Vancouver 4 years ago when he was a mere 83. And I managed to get a ticket 5 rows back. Boy, I tell you, to see a professional at work helps me in my own preaching. You know that? He comes on, he's so relaxed because he knows his material so well. There's a self-confidence, not arrogance. There's a line from self-confidence to arrogance that should not be crossed. You want self-confidence. Confidence in your message. Confidence in your love for the people. Without self-righteousness, without arrogance. He, old Bob Hope, got up there and he's just sort of clowning around. Oh, I tell you, it was fantastic. On TV, it's kind of muted. It's all staged. He's reading his cue cards. In a live performance, he's really Bob Hope. 83 years old, and I tell you, it's the greatest performance I've ever seen. It helped me in my preaching immeasurably. To see the way he just wanted to entertain the audience. The evangelist wants to evangelize the audience. And so I learned a lot from that. He talked for 1 hour. If Bob Hope had talked for 40 minutes, I would have wanted my money back. I would have been gypped. If he talked for 1 hour and 20 minutes, my body would have been tired, and I would have lost the last 20, and the whole 1 hour and 40 would have been less. Hour for a performance is about normal, if you ever notice, for us speakers. I ever heard of Norman Vincent Peale? Now, a lot of people put down power of positive thinking and all this kind of stuff as if it was New Age or weaker, all that kind of thing. I want to tell you, I've learned a lot from people like that. From their style, from their upper attitudes. There's a lot of weaknesses, but there's a lot to be learned. And I went and heard him when he was 93 years old, a mere 93. And these men both demonstrated a care for the audience that came over. I had my 14-year-old twins at that time with me. And they just loved old Norman Vincent Peale. So we can learn a lot from these various people that perform. And so an hour long for that kind of event is good. Now, a couple times I've gone to places and they've put on a youth band, like I said, for 2 20-minute packages. And so the whole hour is used up before I start. And it's murder. The people are just tired now. And it takes everything I've got. And the night's not as good. So look for a good speaker to non-Christians. Men and women sometimes speak well together. A couple. We do use in Vancouver. Well, Vic and Joan Paul, the dentist and his wife, they do a duo thing where one will talk for a few minutes, the other will talk. My wife and I have done it together in homes. We do a lot of these things in homes. We'll go to a high-class home. They'll have 40, 50 people over, maybe 5 Christians and 35 non-Christians. And they're the best of all. And just get up there and we... And sometimes when you get a little bit more professional socioeconomic grouping, then we get a little bit more into apologetics, a little bit more in, you know, how we know it's true type of thing, but always with a personal dimension. The outreach talk should have a high degree of personal story. And in other words, the testimony is best, as long as it's not a self-glorying testimony. Well, I was on drugs, and I was this, and I was that, and I was this, and I was that, and God saved me. You know, with one word for God and 25 words for me. And that's not good. You know, it's something, we're all on the same wavelength here. This is absolutely incredible. So just keep caring. Just keep going and see what the Lord can do in your midst. Strategic planning, thinking, reflecting.
Ask again with the humor. One of the parts of Australian humor is irony. We say the opposite to what we mean.
Yes.
Do you actually say what you mean?
Yes. Yeah, I don't use irony very much myself. However, I'm not talking about canned humor. I almost never tell a joke anymore. Jokes kind of are a little bit out right now in Canada. Humor, humorous incidents, that type of thing. Parts of your story that are a little bit funny. Like we've laughed the odd time today, but none of it. I don't think I even had one stock joke today. If I did, they would all failed anyways. Okay. Self-deprecating humor is best. Not deliberate, canned, you know what I mean, contrived self-deprecatory humor, but self-deprecation is a very healthy thing. Boy, you guys must be tired. Okay, one or two more little helpful things. There's a couple in Red Deer, Alberta. This is current. This is 2 years old. Guy's name is Lawrence Tomalty, dairyman. My age, 48. He was going to a brethren church in Red Deer, not a bad brethren church. That's a little town north of Calgary, halfway from Calgary to Edmonton in Alberta. And their little church was great, but not much evangelism was happening in it. So he decided to start a home Bible study, evangelistic home Bible study. And he did. He had no experience in anything. He just heard the idea it would be a good idea. So he got a little Bible study 2 years ago together. They had 16 people in it. The only Christians were Vicky and Lawrence, 14 non-Christians, all in the 40s, professional, capable people of Red Deer. The kind of people you never think would be interested in the gospel. See, most of our outreach as brethren churches is not going to be down and out outreach. Missions down there, downtown, to some other figment of our imagination. Most of our outreach will be to our peers, our socioeconomic grouping we're in. Now, thankfully, there are those that break out of their own socioeconomic grouping and have almost like a cross-cultural evangelism within their own society. But most of our evangelism is going to take place with our next-door neighbor, not a project down the road, or especially 100 miles down the road. And so Vicky and Lawrence got 16 or so of their socioeconomic group together for a Bible study. Same ground rules. So 2 years ago, he invited me, just a year ago, he invited me to come and address their Bible study. And I thought, boy, my schedule's kind of tight, Lawrence. I'm a little bit nervous about, you know, spending a night with your Bible study group, and I've got all these other things I've got to do. But he was so keen, I couldn't help it. I had to say yes. I went over, and they only had about 10 people there that night because they had to change the night for a night when I was free. This was away from Vancouver. I had to specially be there. And so they only had about 10 people out, but Lawrence and Vicky were the only two long-term Christians, and the other eight or so had just accepted the Lord in the last month. Talk about turned on. They hadn't learned that Christians can get discouraged yet. They were just sort of bright-eyed, bushy-tailed professionals who love Jesus. I've got a Catholic friend in Vancouver. He calls me. He's a top stockbroker of Canada. He accepted the Lord about 4 years ago. And when you're the top stockbroker in Canada, you are good of all companies. And he played football. He was in the Rose Bowl, the big college game in the States. He was a professional football in British Columbia. And just like he drove for that goal line, he just drives for the goal line of the stockbroking, and now he's accepted the Lord. And he just loves the Lord. So he calls him, "Hi, Terry, how's it going?" And then he makes some things. "I've been bringing lots of people to Jesus lately. Oh, I just love that kind of zeal." Well, that's the way old Lawrence and Vicky were with all their brand new Christians, that newfound zeal. So they said, "Could we have an evangelistic outreach sometime, Terry, with you?" And I said, "Oh, sure, for sure." That night of 10 people was so good. These 8 people, they didn't know hardly anything about the Bible, but they were intelligent people. So they were asking these super intelligent questions that any Christian of 2 years could answer. So I really looked good. I mean, I was just answering all their questions, and they had a ball. They thought I knew everything. Well, I knew that didn't take anything to answer brand new Christians' questions, because Christianity stands pretty strong. So we had a banquet 2 weeks ago. It beat anything John and Lorraine have ever done, other than that, those two things I mentioned about the extra emotional dimension to it. They had 160 people out for their first banquet. I don't know, I think they had 31 accepted the Lord. And every one of the people who'd accepted the Lord came from those people in that first Bible study. The Bible study, since last year, has grown to 5 Bible studies. They farmed out all these new Christians and started 5 Bible studies up in this little town of Red Deer, Alberta. And so as of 2 weeks ago, they had 160 people at their first outreach banquet. And it was done first class the whole way. And it's that same principle again of what one couple can do when they taste a little bit. Lawrence is the world's worst speaker. So in case you're not the world's best speaker, don't feel bad. He introduced me, and I almost fell asleep when he introduced me. And then I had to get up and recover the audience that was asleep. And yet that couple, Lawrence and Vicky, had turned that kind of thing around. One more little illustration, just to show I'm not just glorifying one or two people. There was a guy, brethren guy too. Funny how all these people are brethren. This guy was named Dan Horton. He went to a little independent church in a town called Armstrong. They named their church Armstrong Bible Chapel, ABC for short. And he phoned and asked if I'd come and do an outreach banquet. And I thought, well, what can they do in Armstrong? But he was keen, so I said, sure, I'll come along. Dan Horton was his name. I got up there. 200 people were in the basement of this church. He was the reverend, the minister. He was a shop teacher in town. They couldn't find a minister, so they hired him because he loved the people. So here he is. He's a brethren guy who's a reverend now in this church and never even been to Bible school. And he was the town priest, the town parish priest. He knew everybody in town from being teaching shop there for the last 4 or 5 years in this high school. So anyway, 200 people in the banquet, and the same thing again, the comment cards, 200 thick. When everybody went home, Dan and his wife, they couldn't leave. They had to go through the comment cards. In other words, the heart showed. And they went bombing through all these 200 comment cards, and he knew every name there. Just an ordinary guy, shop teacher. He loved people so much they hired him to be the minister. What training did he have? What skills did he have? Not much. We got through a bunch of the cards. He said, oh, so-and-so, this is the wife of the man that owns a pizza parlor. That's neat. She accepted the Lord tonight, Terry. And he said, you know something? His wife, her husband was there tonight, and he didn't fill out a card. Let's go have pizza. So when the banquet's over, Dan and his wife and I are at the pizza parlor visiting with the new Christian lady and her husband. That is the way the success comes. You notice I'm not talking about special gifts. I'm not talking about something unattainable. I'm talking about just having such a heart for people that he knew every one of the 200 cards. And when he recognizes one, boom, we're there that night till 11:30 at night. Those are just some more illustrative things. Oh, please, Betty.
I'm wondering about the ability of we Christians to cope with the ability of the non-Christian to be shockable. In other words, I'm saying the Australian non-Christian through our culture...
Is a little loose.
Yeah, and I wonder if you cope with that, if that happens in Canada, the unpredictable that can come from our conversations... And for our ability to go on without blinking.
Good.
That's
so good.
Swear word.
Did they swear in Australia?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that.
No, I just think that there's a generally trend for them to be, Christians can be shocked.
Yes, that's so good. You know, that's so down to earth. We've got to spend so much time with non-Christians that we're totally comfortable at all stages. And every time we see somebody, we're not witnessing words. We are in long-term relationships, usually. Our neighbor has been living there for a while and will probably live there for a while. Our first encounter, we don't try and tell them how to accept the Lord. We win friendship by spending time with them, by being with them. And that helps the shock question. We just are totally familiar and comfortable with everything that sort of comes by. And let's never major on minors, either, if somebody's lifestyle isn't something that we would condone. I would say the force of the New Testament teaching is that we are to spend a lot of time with the non-condonable people in society. In other words, let's not be judgmental, let's be very accepting. We're really ministering to the hurt and the lost, and we're doctors, spiritual doctors. Thank you, Betty. That's very good. Yeah, let's not be square, let's not be out of it, and I don't mean let's all of a sudden try to be something we're not either. People like down-to-earth realness. People who love others. We got a guy who just accepted the Lord in our church, Mike Manning's his name, at Granville Chapel. Our last guest Sunday in January, he was praying for 9 people on his card. The reason we know is my wife happened to draw his card. And he was praying for 9 people to come to the service. And so it turns out, 6 turned him down that time, and 3 said yes, and that morning 0 came. Mike's still hanging in there, he's still praying for his buddies. So in other words, and he's out there in the university with quite a rowdy crowd. To get 1 of the 9 out of that circumstance would have been good. He was sure there'd be 3. He was down. He was heartsick that none of his 3 prayees, invitees, had arrived. I'm trying to get across the idea. We've got to be salt outside the salt shaker. We've got to get those 2 concentric circles overlapping. The with it turned on loving Christians and the people who don't know the gospel. We don't live in a Christian society in Australia any more than we live in a Christian society in Canada. People aren't rejecting Christ. They've never heard of Christ. Boy, you guys are so sharp. Yes?
Do you find that the banquet has quite effective if they are being tried in the evangelism?
Yes. As a matter of fact, they don't even necessarily need to overlap, but they're more effective. I'm glad you pointed that out when they do overlap, because you've got... You're feeding the home Bible studies into the banquets, and sometimes the banquet is the reaping. It's like a reaping time. So if you've got a bunch of Bible studies going together, what a natural reap. But to tell you the truth, the only people that happened to, in our 32 banquets last year, that had home Bible studies were just Lawrence and John. Lawrence and Vicky and John and Lorraine were the only 2 that had a Bible study program that folded into the banquets. The other 30 banquets I was at last year didn't happen to have the benefit of the home Bible studies. But many of them started up home Bible studies for the new Christians after, called nurture groups. I would recommend all of your churches have nurture groups for brand new people to the faith on a regular basis. And that's a very, very good thing. And a lot of people accept the Lord through these Bible studies. We're having them at Granville now. We have 6 people enrolled right now. We've had about 20 baptisms at Granville in the last year for salvation. So it's been encouraging. Bill Heibel's church had 1,000 baptisms last year. of new converts, 1,000. Because they just cared so much that they took the actions to reach the people. So in other words, you can add an evangelistic dinner to your setting, whether it's 20 people or 200. I can't believe, Cedric, that you guys have 285 people coming here. That is just absolutely astounding. That's bigger than my average banquet. The average banquet I speak at is 150, maybe 180 average. I've spoken at banquets as few as 40 people. I'm not big time. I'd rather speak to a banquet of 40 where there's 20 non-Christians than a banquet of 20 where there's of 200 where there's only 10 non-Christians. There's a reality in the atmosphere when you get a lot of people that aren't believers together.
Are banquets your main outreach in that sense?
They are now. We did these major crusades. We did about 40 major citywide crusades. And every crusade was two, remember. We had to go with the Christians the first time and then with the non-Christians the second, plus all the preliminary things. I could only do two crusades in a year. So over 15 years, we did about 30 major crusades, some of them very, very large, some of them relatively small. And we had gone to every city in Canada. And the time involved in putting these crusades together was killing me. And our television ministry was seen by so many people, I had to reevaluate my time. And so last year, we did 32 banquets, which is the same as 4 8-day crusades. We actually saw more people come to faith at our 32 banquets last year than we used to see in an entire year of our mega crusades, which is interesting. If you're going to do crusades, do them freshly. If you're going to have an evangelistic program in your church, what I'd recommend is not Sunday to Sunday of gospel meetings. I don't even know if they're still done anymore in local churches. They may still be periodically. I'd recommend a Friday, Saturday, Sunday punch. Friday night youth barbecue. Saturday night adult banquet. Sunday services, Sunday morning and Sunday night. And things like that where it's a little bit more focused. People are busier in the 1990s than they were in the 1960s. 1960, put a sign out and you'd fill the church. 1990, boy, you know, break your neck and you only half fill the church. We had to, in 1986, work twice as hard, spend four times as much money to get the same size as audience as the 70s in a mass crusade. So I found the dinners. Now, I'm not really talking about a gimmick. See, there's nothing gimmicky about a dinner. A dinner is something we've had since the days of life began. It's the staff of life, bread. And so people sharing bread together is a human dimension. It's not a gimmick that we discovered that will pass. It's not a fad. It's capitalizing on a natural occasion for receptivity.
Churches have got ongoing evangelism going on through their people, through other things, other than that one bang time a year.
Yeah, I wish they did. Some of them do, some of them don't. I want to tell you, my friends, I said at the beginning, this is the golden era of the church in many ways. But at the same time, I said, where have all the evangelists gone? There's not much evangelism happening in Canada. Almost zip. A few Bible studies here, a few guest services there, a few affinity groups. Affinity groups means where people are alike, a ladies' coffee hour, a single mother's sharing support group, a lawyer's fellowship, a doctor's outreach, anything that has an affinity-ness to it. There's a few of those happening when you get a few bright-eyed hot shots in a certain profession will want to reach to their affinity group. You see a little bit of that. You see some guest services. Youth are always the best in evangelism because youth seem to have all the more friends and they're not so set in their ways already. And so there's a bit of youth evangelism happening. But I have to tell you, in Canada, there's not much evangelism. I try to find a guest for our TV show. I have to get Americans. We're woefully negligent in Canada in evangelism. I've been hitting the highlights today of the things that I know that are happening. It's not that broadly based, the success in evangelism. So I want to encourage you, if you think you're not doing all that much, boy, Canada's a million miles ahead. Terry Winter sure told some big stories. It's tough slugging. Yes, Theron, in there.
You said earlier that youth were idealists. How do you associate that with speaking again?
Oh, well, when you're talking to the kids, I mean, you've got to really present a credible message. I mean, they're going to see something. They're going to see if you really mean it. They're going to see if it really applies. In other words, you can't pull the wool over kids' eyes. So when you're speaking to youth, that's one of the best training grounds of all for communication. Youth are alert. And as I say, they're idealistic. They want something that's really going to count in their lives. And you can really give them the goods. Like Urbana, the big convention that they have in America for university students, has 18,000 come every 3rd December. And they get up there and these speakers and they just give them the good old basics and the kids eat it up. Idealism and basics go hand in hand. And so, like, I like Christianity that's got punch to it. I don't like a watered down at all. Punch is content, not tone. A fella called me. I saw him 15 years ago, one of these little things happening in the night. A Salvation Army man. He said, Terry, I'd like to get involved in... Not 15 years ago, but 10 years ago. I'd like to get involved in evangelism. Have you got any recommendations? Oh, boy, you know, you don't know anybody. What can you say? I said, get every ounce of education you can get. Get your doctor's degree if you can. You need it in the 1990s to be an evangelist. That's all I said. Never saw him again. Forgot about him. Never even knew I ever knew him. I got a phone call. I left Canada Thursday. Got a phone call Wednesday at noon from Ontario, long distance. He was paying the bill. He talked 45 minutes. He said, Terry, I met you down in Fort Lauderdale at the Billy Graham School of Evangelism, and you helped me a lot. I said, yeah, what did I say? He said, get an education. So I've done it. And thank you for that advice. Like, I'm strong on that. Real strong. Get every ounce of education you can get when you go into Christian work. And so he did it. He's now working on his doctorate. He's got his Master of Divinity. And he said, Terry, I want to go, and I've already been appointed to be the head of evangelism for the Salvation Army of Canada. Well, that will produced a way. So he says, have you got anything to say? So I shared some of the things I've been talking with you, 45 minutes worth, on the long-distance phone to Toronto. And I basically said, this is not a confrontational age. This is an age, his name was Henry. I said, this is not a confrontational age, Henry. And we've got an evangelist in Canada who's a little bit confrontational. And he used to know him quite well, and I know him quite well, too. He's a nice guy. And we mentioned this fellow's name. And I said, that style was of the 50s, Henry. He said, I know it in my bones. I just knew it. And I said, what you got to do is have almost the outstretched hand of explanation instead of the pointed finger of condemnation. That's the style of today. And then I said, the other thing keep in mind, and this is something I meant to say, and I'm glad that somehow or other came up now. When you're speaking to an audience, never feel they're the enemy. The enemy isn't there. The people who are out there, especially at a dinner, but in all circumstances, voted to be there. They came. They're already on side. So you're not trying to convince the unconvincible. You're not trying to wear down the barriers to break through to the people's souls. They're basically saying, how can I be saved? How can I be fulfilled? How can I love my wife? How can my kids have a life that's together? How can I find God? So when I talk to people on television, or at a banquet, or in any setting, I am inviting them to Christ. I am not convincing them they need Christ. Now, there's a dimension of apologetics in there. There's a dimension of all of these other things in there. But it's minor key. The major key is explaining to people that are with you, or they wouldn't be sitting there. And this guy, Henry, said, man, you're exactly right. And so, you know, he was all cranked up on the telephone, just with a few of these orientation things. And it's interesting to have the Salvation Army appointing a young, aggressive evangelist for Canada. Because Salvation Army, he said, is known for its social work in Canada. And he said, we want to get back to more evangelism. Yes?
I was going to mention about church services on Sunday.
Yes.
You talked about Hybels and having his gear towards the non-church person. In a Christian Brethren church, that probably is not going to happen the same way. But you also mentioned about not having Sunday evening services.
Yes.
Therefore, how does, say, a traditional Brethren church reorientate so they don't have an evening service, and what are those people doing? How have they set the day's program so that you are free to do some of the things you're saying? In other words, instead of having three or four services a day on Sunday when you go, the schedule's been changed so that there's less time sitting or listening, but there is free time to use to be a friend of a sinner.
And so you say, well, how can they structure their programs to allow that, or what do they do with the free time?
How do they structure the program?
Okay.
The time table.
I think the best setting or best system for Sunday services is to focus periodic Sundays. I like guest Sundays. And they're called guest Sundays. Just like friendship banquets are called friendship banquets. Guest Sunday means we're inviting our guests to church. And the guest doesn't feel like a goat sitting there with the sheep when he's called a guest. Oh, I remember the old days when I was first converted and I come along to the good old gospel hall there I went to, and the preacher got to say, on the prayer at the beginning of the service, and the Lord bless the strangers here tonight. Strangers meant strange to the gospel, I think. I'm not sure. But oh, the funny little ways we've done things over the years. Instead of just communicating friendly in a friendly fashion. The zeal was there, but maybe a little misdirected or non-sufficiently directed. Guest Sundays are the best, and I think about one a quarter is a nice balance. So you can't be giving a gospel message every Sunday, or you won't feed the saints. And you don't have a huge number of non-Christians there on the average Sunday. But if you're having a guest Sunday, then you focus on those Sundays. At Granville, we do not have the communion as part of the guest Sunday. We have the communion that Sunday on a night where just the faithful gather for the communion. Unfortunately, fitting in communion is the problem. There's no ideal system. I wish there were. Maybe Bill Hybels has got it right. Maybe all Brethren Church communions should be Thursday night, and then there'd be no problem. But anyway, we have a problem, and let's face it. And so I'm not against communion. I'm for it. I'm trying to figure out how you combine communion with ministry to non-Christians. By the time you have a communion service and a Sunday school and a outreach service, you're getting an awful lot of services, and then some of the Christians who don't like to go to three or four services start complaining. And it's just tough.
But the problem for the non-church person is they come to our worship service, our communion service, they have no idea what's happening.
I know, that's what bothers me. I mentioned that earlier today too. That's why I don't like combining it in all the time. I think a little bit of both. At Granville, I'm really happy with the Granville system. We have one Sunday of the month where communion is involved. But it's not like marrying two services together. We tried that for a few years too, where we then have a short message, a short song service, and then a short communion service and put them all into one service. And we did nothing. You know, you try to aim at two things and you fall between both. And everything falls apart. That's when we hit that low ebb and we left, actually. We didn't leave over. We just left because there's nobody there for our kids to know. And that's why we were trying everything all at once. Somehow we got the idea. Communion service has to be a brother leads in prayer. And then another brother gives a hymn. And then another brother shares from the Word. And then we have a brother stand up and give the this and that. Have you ever noticed, friends? I'm just shaking you up a little bit here. That it's not very biblical. It's just tradition. And it may be good tradition. But let's think through these things. So when we combine the communion with the service, at the end of the service, one of the elders or Tim or one of the people comes up to the microphone with the bread and said, "Now we're going to break the bread as the Lord told us to do. If you love the Lord, please feel free to join us." And they just break it and pass it out, and then they do the same with the wine. And it's like a part of, not another service tacked on. That helps a little bit. If you can make that fit the other service instead of marrying two non-compatible items together. I think once in a month is not a bad way to do it, and then maybe the three on a Sunday night or something. Boy, this is touchy. It's not touchy because I've got an answer. I haven't got an answer. I struggle with it all the time. People ask me, "What do you recommend for the perfect system?" So I don't know. Maybe Bill Hybels, as I say, has got it best. But then some brother will say it's supposed to be Sunday. So I just said that for humor.
And then they have a special outreach Bible hour on the fourth Sunday and have a fellowship lunch.
Yeah.
And at the end of that lunch, around the table, they just break the bread and have communion service. And I think it works excellent.
Sure.
Thank you very much. You know something? Well, that points out, there's no perfect plan. Just have a plan. You know, if you just sort of keep doing things always the way you've done without a plan, you know, you can keep doing what you've always done, hit nothing. But get a plan, and there's no perfect plan. I hope that nobody here is saying, "Boy, old Terry's trying to import what they do in Vancouver." I'm trying to stimulate you to think of your plan. See, I happen to get along with the most ultra-conservative people in the world. I even went to an ex-Taylor meeting for a year. So I'm a little bit aware of the different things that you're thinking. Yes?
With the banquet, do you move people into another hall, say, from there into here?
No, that's a very good question. We have on the outside balcony into the barn. But generally it's best if they're seated at their table. It's almost like their table becomes their security blanket. In other words, you want people to be totally comfortable. And so we either go for round tables or rectangular tables, and the people are seated right at their tables, and they kind of feel protected and all those kind of things. They've got a sort of a moat around them, the moat of the table. So you're asking such excellent practical questions. Most flaws in outreach are not theological. They're practical. They're pragmatic. It's very interesting. I don't see where any hang-ups are theologically with evangelism. I think it's just practically following through our theology. So I like those kinds of questions. And another thing is, just practical, we'll do it tonight, have everybody at the end of the meal stand up, stretch, and turn their chairs facing to the front. If nobody ever thinks of saying that, the people are sitting at their table watching the speaker. Wiggle their chair a quarter of the way around, but the lady behind them's chair is there, and they can't, you know. Just little things like that. Yeah.
Like tea and coffee, is that over and done with? Because you get, I mean, if I was sitting at a table, I'd be fiddling with the serviette. There'd be no doubt about it. I'd be playing with something. So what do you do? What do you do to make sure people aren't fiddling with you?
Yeah, that's interesting. I never thought about the fiddling part before. That's just most interesting. I guess maybe the odd person does and I don't notice it. We do want the tables cleared, though. But not usually of the coffee cups. I guess the coffee cups, if the people have finished, are cleared. So I guess what happens is there's a naturalness. The waiters are taking out the main plates while the people are having the dessert and coffee, and I guess some people finish their dessert and coffee, you know, a little earlier than others, and the waiters take them out too. So I guess what happens is 50% of the coffee cups and spoons are already gone, and nothing else is on the table, and I've asked the people to turn their chairs to face forward, so anybody on that side of the table will have to reach back. So I guess it looks after itself, but I never really thought about some of those very fine point details. Boy, I like the way you're thinking.
At the end of an evening,
yes,
after you have finished speaking, and what is this format for closing off if people want to hang around and talk?
Very good. Usually, they hang around and talk. Sometimes by instruction, other times just by, again, I was surprised how much naturalness that I've never thought of how these things do happen. I always end it with saying, thank you, ladies and gentlemen. And I try to talk English, like ladies and gentlemen and all this kind of stuff, you know. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for a wonderful evening tonight. And then I say, I'm going to ask Cedric Gibbs, the minister of the church here, to come up and say a final greeting to you, or a final, it's not greeting, whatever, a final word to you all. And then that gives me a chance usually to get to the back of the banquet hall so I can say goodbye to people walking out. And then whoever it is, Cedric, would come up and say, now the evening's over, and if you'd like to stay at your table and visit for a while, go ahead. By the suggestion, with Lawrence and Vicky's banquet last week in Red Deer, Alberta, almost 90% of the people stayed and sat and chat at their tables. Other times everybody just gets up and goes. It's sort of a natural, and it doesn't matter. It's good, though, I find, to have the minister come up and say a couple of words at the end, because it establishes who the minister is. And it gives me a little recommendation to say, if you haven't got a church to go to, come to this church. This is the one thing I meant to underline on my first sentence, along with that other comment about the need of pastors. Most evangelism today is taking context of a local church. I am really strong on the local church. And the local church is a very good vehicle for evangelism. And so you'd be interested to have gathered that. And get pastors in your church. Somebody else mentioned that to me at lunchtime today. We need pastors for two reasons. If I'm going to a doctor, I don't want a fellow who said, oh, I think I've got a little spare time, I'll be your doctor. You know, I usually am a lawyer, but, you know, I've always had a side interest in doctoring. No, sir. I'm going to the best specialists I can find. And let's face it, we need ministers who are specialists, who take the time to get the training, to learn how to counsel, to learn how to do things, to study theology. We need professionals. The early brethren were all professionals. This whole idea that we're every man's, every person's gifted from the Lord and all this, and we all do all things together and the Spirit teaches us, I don't understand what's being said when I hear all those sentences. We are all gifted by the Lord, and we're to exercise our gifts. And if our gifts and our calling is to serve the Lord in a full-time capacity, let's get every bit of training, and let's learn from each other. That's why some denominations that have denominational conferences, which are not sermons, but where there are workshops on how to do this and how to do that, pragmatic times. That's what it was so good about this conference the brethren had in Detroit. It was pragmatic. It was how do you do things? Combined, obviously, with the biblical bases. That's all part of pragmatism, healthy pragmatism. And then you get a person in your church who knows how to do things and goes to places to learn how to do things. I tell you, my friends, in case you're a little bit worried that I'm pushing professionalism a little too much, I care for the world around too much for them to be lost, because we want to follow what we call tradition or something. Now, I know I'm speaking to the already converted. Every person's here because you already want to be here. And you've already voted, as my friend Cedric, who's got such an IQ. Cedric, you just blow me out of the water. Every one of your words is so apt. I think he's the one that's talked about the divine discontent. And then he said, everyone here is self-selective. You know what that means? You selected in being here. In other words, you're not an enemy that came into the audience today who's against being progressive. You want to mean business or you wouldn't be here. You self-selective people, you. And so, but I tell you, my friends, we have got a world that's perishing. And if we've got a church of 51 people that has not won anyone to the Lord in the last 3 years, that is not biblical. We've got to win people to Christ. Not by compromising, not by sacrificing principle. Not by watering down theology. Have I talked water down anything today? Very, very strong love for the Lord. Do you know the best form of evangelism, the best means of evangelism of all? Get so in love with the Lord, you radiate. That's the best. And then all the other means follow. And when you get people that are just so in love with people, like John and Lorraine, they just love people in the kingdom. Vic and Joan, they love people in the kingdom. Lawrence and Vicky. Dan Horton, the parish priest of Armstrong, British Columbia, just loving people into the kingdom. And so we've got to care if we're not winning people to Christ. Boy, I tell you, I've sure loved being here. Thank you.
I was a wee bit surprised to hear you say you wait till the banquet is over and people have gone, then you pick up the commentary card and head off for a little recluse somewhere to count them and see who's doing what. We've been used to the idea of giving a pool and asking people to come forward and tell us if they've accepted the Saviour, but you're apparently doing a different system. Do you then follow those people up individually or with the people who bought them? Or?
That's a very good question again. Boy, your questions are practical. We don't use the comment cards on a Sunday other than once in 5 years. Every once in a while on the guest Sunday, we'll do that. Because if you start doing something every time, then it loses it's too much familiarity and it loses its edge. So once in a while on a Sunday, we did it. Our guest Sunday last year, we had everyone fill out a comment card. We have pencils in the places, and it was ideal for follow-up. But at our evangelistic dinners or home parties, the comment card is ideal. And so, I mean, any of the places that put on these banquets really have to mean business. As a matter of fact, it's interesting in Canada, of my outreach banquets, I've only done 4 in brethren churches. I've done 150 in other churches. So I'm not saying that that the brethren in Canada are a million miles ahead of any brethren down here, even in evangelism. Isn't that interesting that the way that's fallen to pass? And I'm trying to plug them. I've never done an evangelistic banquet in Vancouver in a brethren church. And so Granville now is starting to think of doing one. Oh, I did one at Heather Chapel. You were at Heather one time. I did one there. That's the only one in Vancouver. I've done a couple in Victoria at Oakland's Chapel. Oh, man, the Brethren Church is there. And those guys are really alive at Oakland's Chapel and evangelism. Anyways, at the outreach banquets, we use the cards. And as I said, the churches are usually pretty committed or they're not going to go ahead with the banquet. The follow-up committee is equally committed. And they get together the day after the banquet, invariably. And they go over the cards, and the card is so thorough. It has the name and address of everybody, the guest, or the host who brought them. They're the guest of someone. And so the committee says, okay, we already know the situation here. So-and-so brought so-and-so, and they already know that the person is up to the Lord, and they're looking after it. Oh, here's someone we better check. So in other words, everyone is accounted for by the follow-up committee, either by something that they already know or by something that they do. And it's interesting, not everybody wants to follow up their own friend. Some people find it better if a third party does. So a phone call is made to the guest, to the host, to see if they would like to follow up the person or if a member of the committee should. And then by Wednesday, if the banquet's on a Saturday, we have everybody of the follow-up committee meet back together again and review the progress. And then take the next step and the next step. And the goal is to get every single one of the comment people into a home Bible study. Now, not everybody is accepting the Lord in these numbers. You may get 30 kicks on a banquet of 200. 20 of them may be first-time salvation decisions. 5 of them still don't quite know it yet. And 5 of them were Christians before. They just want to make sure. So we're not statistical. I've mentioned a few numbers as guidelines, but we're not too statistical. But we want to get everybody involved in a home Bible study as a result of the function. I'm getting mixed up on the time. Is it 20 past 2?
With the Bible studies for non-Christians you were talking about earlier on,
yes.
What type of things were you studying?
Generally, the Gospels. One of the 4 Gospels, generally. And And they usually make these non-Christian Bible studies of a specific length in time, 6 or 8 or 10 weeks, so people don't think they're committing themselves for the rest of their lives. All of these user-friendly concepts. That's a big word in computer technology, user-friendly. Let's make everything we do user-friendly, so people are not threatened by the unknown. Yes?
Can you just give more details about the television program, like AIM's services, what day of the week you put on, what time, things like that?
I don't know how translatable it would be to here. In a sense, it's a reflection of our own personal style. It's on across Canada 4 times every Sunday on all the major stations, like the biggest station in every city, the second biggest station in every city. And there's a Christian, a religious network now across Canada, cable. It's not the same as the American religious networks of Jimmy Baker and so on. It's not Christian. It's religious. The Canadian government will not license a private Christian anything. There's no Christian radio station in Canada, no Christian television station in Canada, and no private network allowed. The Canadian Radio and Television Commission, the CRTC, disallows it. So we're in a sense poorer, but in a sense richer too. We don't have to counter with all this nonsense south of the border that really has been so disruptive. So one group of do-gooders started a religious network called Vision TV. Why they did it, I don't know. They have the Mujahideen, the Muslims on, the Buddhists, the Seventh-day Adventists, the Christians, but all the different groups. And we're on that. We weren't going to go on at first. We thought, boy, that's a terrible religious mortgage board. Mind you, is that any worse than the secular TV? But we eventually went on and found out that the Buddhists and the Muslims haven't got any money anyway. They're only on a half an hour a week. And it's mostly the Christians that are on, which is kind of good. And so we're on that. And that's twice a Sunday. So we're on Sunday in Vancouver at 9:30 in the morning, 1 o'clock in the afternoon, 3 in the afternoon, and 6 at night on one of those 4 outlets. It's a 15-minute interview with an outstanding guest, as I mentioned this morning. Then I offer the book written by the guest to anyone who'd like to write and ask for it. And then I give a 10-minute talk. As far as the religious shows, it's a million miles ahead of the second. But then, if you've got John Stott and Michael Green and Johnny Erickson, Bill Hybels and Chuck Swindoll and James Dobson, those are our guests for the last year. that says nothing if it's the highest rated program. If it wasn't the highest rating, there'd be something wrong with it. It's my perfect style. I'm not a hero. All I do is bring the heroes to the public. And so I sit back and ask a couple of questions and let Chuck Swindoll glow the Lord. And then I say, after Chuck's gone, I say, now I'd like to give everyone who's writing a copy of Chuck Swindoll's newest book. And we get them for 70% off. They're $20 books. We get them for about $4 and we give them away. And we don't raise money on the air. We raise it from Christians behind the scenes. And that's the tough part. That's really tough, raising funds. Whew.
You said that many people watch your show across the country, and we get 500 letters a week. Was that right?
Well, we get between 500 and 1,000 letters a week. I said 500 on the low side. They figure that there's a one letter represents 1,000 watchers. That's the industry guideline. Also, in addition to the ratings that the government produces for us. And so the weeks that we get 500 letters, theoretically we had 500,000 viewers. The weeks we get 1,000 letters, we theoretically had 1,000,000 viewers. One person rates out of 1,000 generally.
How many people do you know of that actually come to Christ through that ministry? And then what do you do to follow up?
That ministry is truly broadcasting the gospel like seed. You can't follow up. 99.9% of the people who do watch and make a decision anyways, could only 0.1% ever writes to you. So you know that you can never do anything more for 99.9% of the people. Except you are there the next week, and the next week, and the next week. So that's the beauty of that. Everybody that does write to us, the 0.1, we do everything we can. We recommend them to churches, and if the letter is such that it looks like we should have phone someone in the town, we phone someone in the town. The largest Brethren church in the world is Calgary, Bethany Chapel, 1,000 people. I was there about 5-6 years ago, and this guy came up to me, he's hunchback, badly crippled. He said, thank you for your television program. I accepted the Lord the first day it was on in Calgary. And so he told me the story. And what had happened is he was deformed. Kids picked on him. He had no friends. His life was his television set. By this time he's 18, and he flipped on the TV, saw the program. I prayed at the end to accept the Lord. He prayed to accept the Lord. He wrote into us and he told us. He said, I'm deformed. People have picked on me. My only life is my television set. So we knew if we told him to go to church, he never would. So I called Gary Enrig, the pastor of the Brethren Church in Calgary. And I told him. So Gary sent one of the elders over and visited the guy, brought the fellow to church. Now he runs the sound system at the church, and the last time I was there, he served the communion. I thought that was really neat. People say television evangelism doesn't work, and here's a fellow passing me the communion, who was a convert of the first television program in Calgary. And he's still a member of the Bethany Chapel. So we know of isolated instances. As I speak across Canada from Sunday to Sunday or week to week, I guess I never go to a meeting without somebody come up and saying, we accept the Lord in either the television or the rallies or the banquets you've had. So there is some carry through. It's not absolutely phenomenal. I like what St. Paul said, I am all things to all men, so that by all possible means I might save some. I'm not a triumphalist. I'm not boasting about, hey, man, we're reaching Canada. We're nibbling at it.
Yes. Barriers that restrict progress.
Sorry, barriers?
Barriers. What do you see as the major barriers that restrict progress in general brethren centers?
Okay. I'll just reword the question for the microphone. What barriers are restricting progress in brethren churches? Oh, that's a tough one. I guess traditionalism. We've always done it this way. It's biblical, so we'll always do it this way. It's usually not biblical. It's usually cultural. It's usually conditioning. It's usually personal taste. So I'd say traditionalism is deadly. Just deadly. But I'm not anti-tradition. I happen to be for tradition. But you build on it, and you go from there, and you serve the Lord in your own generation. Secondly, non-professionalism, amateurism, where a bunch of people that really don't know how to run a church are running a church. If we're going to operate a church, let's learn from each other, and then let's put it into practice. And if we don't have a pastor, if we don't have a conference to go to, a support group to go to, if we don't get the chance to interpollinate with other people, cross-pollinate, it's just deadly and we'll just sort of wither on the vine. And connected into those two comments are pride. And so we've got to really try to be humble that we're not, we don't have the truth. All these brethren conferences pointed out as number one, pride, that we have the truth. And that is just so deadly. And so having love seems to be absolutely essential. Love for each other, love for the Lord, and love for the lost. And that tends to overcome all of those. But I worded the word for shock value amateurism. I calculatedly said that just to point out a point. I said earlier, I'm for passing out a tract. I'm for putting a Gideon Bible in a drawer. I'm for putting a television program on the TV set. But you don't stop at that. As we said, you think through those letters you do get. You think through how to do that banquet better. You think through turning the chairs around. You think through the comment cards. You think through. You go to Bill Heibel's seminar and you find out what they've learned. You go to I was last two Sundays ago at Hollywood Presbyterian Church in L.A., checking out the minister there for our television program. And boy, that Hollywood Presbyterian Church is called First Presbyterian Hollywood. You probably know it well. First Presbyterian Church in Hollywood lives for evangelism. And it came out reeking through their service. I was so encouraged to go there. So you've got to free up pastors and leaders and full-time workers to go to these kind of settings to learn. Could you imagine a company being run by a group of people that don't know anything about the company? And then wondering why it doesn't grow anywhere. And you see, we can't run a church that way. Now, we can all know something about the Lord. We know something about the Bible. But a church is a lot more than knowing about the Bible and about the Lord. The church is how to function to serve the Lord. What about these verses? I'm all things to all men, so by all possible means I might save some. Study to show yourself approved unto God. A workman, you know, thoroughly equipped for every good work. Oh my goodness. That means going to the places where they can really train you from what they've learned. I can see the difference, my friends. I go along to a church and they just do things bang upright. And I go to a little brethren assembly and settling along and you feel so sad. So I'm really for breaking tradition and for getting full-time workers trained and experienced. I'm not saying to become arrogant. And if I'm giving any idea of I'm arrogant, I'm not. I'm so reeking with flaws and failures, but I care so much for non-Christians and so much for the Christian body. And any denomination that's not growing, that can't be too biblical. So thank you for that question. Does that help a little bit? Traditionalism is an enemy, and not knowing is maybe a better word than amateurism. And then not having the full-time staff. And you've got to build multi-church staffs. You just have to. You just have to. Every brethren church, I said at the beginning, maybe it's a good way to end, in North America with a pastor basically is growing. And almost every brethren church without one is not. And I don't know if I know a single exception to that rule. Glad somebody asked that. My personal preference, a lot of these things are my personal preference, is 75%. I like it when the pastor speaks 75% of the time. And other gifted people from the congregation, the other 20. And the last 5%, the outside speaker. I'm not big on outside speakers. I do not like to be an outside speaker. I almost never speak on Sunday. I'm in the church with my own family or away at an evangelistic weekend or something. But I get asked for Sunday sermons. And I just have only so many days in the year, and so that's not a good way to expend my days. So I'll speak at a guest Sunday, and in my own church I'll speak, because I'm from there and I know their heartbeat, and I think consecutive ministry is absolutely essential. And at Granville, the ministry committee of four or five, and I explained to somebody at lunch today, that you don't want the elders to do everything. You want to get a lot of involvement of people. And you want to get committees of worship, committees of youth, committees of visitation. Do you know the one thing that any church could do is visitation? You don't have to be a trained psychologist to be a visitor. And that's the biggest failing. Maybe failing number four to your question. What was your first name again, Bob? Bruce. Bruce, maybe the best fourth point there would be if the first one was traditionalism, second one is not knowing amateurism, third one is not freeing up somebody full-time to do it and becoming professional, the fourth would be the thoroughness of visitation. Most people that are sick never get visited among the Christians. What about the non-Christian who cares in the door? The good churches I know all have a minister of visitation. That's their full-time job. And the brethren, where you get a lot of lay involvement, can make for good visiting churches if you got a plan. So visitation is absolutely essential. So anyways, you get all these committees in your church, but I think you should have consecutive ministry based on Bible books most of the time. You can go through topical series periodically. Change is as good as a rest. But biblical exposition, solid meat, that builds churches. And so I think that the pastor speaking three quarters of the time, there's consistency. Like at Granville, we've got one huge weakness. Tim only speaks 50% of the time because that's the way it was. And Tim doesn't want to force himself forward and say, hey, I'd like to speak 80% of the time. So good old Terry's gone to the elders. And one of the elders who speaks is his dad, and he's happily stepped aside. And so he'll step aside for his son anytime. And so we're working on a couple of the others who aren't quite as gifted as Tim, because we're reading the crowd. The days Tim speaks, the crowd's up. The days when it's announced Tim's not, the crowd's down. Tim is gifted by the Lord in teaching, incredibly so. And so in Tim's case, he's got to get to 75-80% real fast, or the church will really suffer. So consecutive ministry of the same person, or one or two. Sometimes you'll have a team in your church where you got two or three naturals. Well, use your two or three naturals. But every man take his turn, and every woman take their turn, is not as good, I don't think, as the gifted people speaking. And there's other occasions for people to learn. Now, the one good thing about the brethren is young people get a chance to work in brethren settings. But don't necessarily give them the Sunday morning a slot. Give them other slots along the way, or maybe chairman of the Sunday morning, things like that. Does that help a little bit? Oh, you guys, you're wearing me right out. Anything less? Last.
Can I just make a comment? Those of us who study church growth, assembly growth in Australia, have found that there are three distinctives of growth: the Word of God, prayer, and leadership.
Yes.
And it just so happens that where they are in place are in assemblies that have full-time pastors.
Now, I'd never heard that before. That is very interesting. Now, by the way, I happen to buy those three things. I've never heard you heard that summary before. But the prayer is something that I've assumed. Well, we're not to today. That's sort of been underwritten, underlining everything we've been saying. What was your first point again? Bible?
The Word of God,
yep, the Bible.
Prayer, and leadership.
That fits in with what Bruce asked me earlier when I said professionalism. I should have used the word leadership. They've done some assessments in Canada, and it seems like leadership in North America is the missing ingredient.
The pastor that's doing his job will be attending to those.
And the others get done. We can't function without leaders, friends. We absolutely need them. The proof of the pudding's in the eating. Just look around. And if Australia finds the same thing, we found the same thing in North America. Let's pray and lean in those ways. But could I say, pay your pastors well. Now, I'm paid very well now. I was not. I had a mother-in-law bail us out for years and years and years. And I want to tell you, the strain was incredible. It was not motivational. It wasn't proper. And it was all because of, well, people said salaries are wrong and you should pay the pastor small so he's not working for an earthly reward, so he's working for the Lord. And all of these kinds of reasonings. Pay your people well and you'll get money, you'll get mileage for your money. Like the churches that do well, treat their staffs well. And don't make the pastor subservient to all kinds of rules and regulations. Keep him in his place. Give him the real sense that he is a leader with you. He's not dominating you. He's a leader with you, serving with you. And that's true leadership, is servanthood. And I know some brethren assemblies have hired pastors, and he's not even an elder. So the elders meet, and he's allowed to come in for a few minutes and then leave. It's demeaning. It's improper. It's silly. So solid business principles are principles. All of a sudden we're spiritual. Doesn't mean we sacrifice solid business principles. Thanks.
Some group teachers are not necessarily good administrators.
That's very good. In fact, usually not.
Yes. So having a full-time person may still leave the church shorthanded in terms of administration.
That's why I personally like multi-staff churches. In a day of specialty, in a day when there's first class this here, first class there, we want to run the church first class too. And so I think you want to work toward little bigger churches and multi-staff churches. It's 2:40. This session is 1 hour old, 2 hours old. Any last question? Yes.
How can we sense to be a big drawback with leadership or elders in the church? They think that too many of them and us. How do you get that overlapping where there's communication and a feeling of, I don't know, accountability or whatever?
You know, have you noticed how honest I've been with you? I have not held back a sentence. I have not calculated a word. That is my huge problem also. Sometimes when we're elders, we think we're something special. And we've lost a sense of servanthood. And we talk about we elders. And that happens so much of the time. Sometimes just because a person's older, they're an elder. All different kinds of things. I love it when an elder, 55 or 60 years old, says, you know, I'm getting a little old to be an elder. I'm going to retire and pass it on to younger men. Now, every once in a while, there's an elder who's 65 or 70 who ought to serve till he's 90. But sometimes retirement of elders makes me glow all over to think that their heart is so sensitive. Did I say something wrong? And eldership is a serious calling. It's not a privilege, it's a responsibility. And I'm speaking as a person who served for 10 years as an elder as a failure. Like I was not a good elder. I was traveling across Canada, and so I even went to the elders, and Jim Houston, the president of Regent College, the two of us, were given honorary advisor leadership roles in the church where we could put in what we've learned across the country. So we really were not even, we were ex officio elders. And I felt way better that way. I think an elder ought to be super humble, super in love with the Lord, super in love with the people, very teachable.